Velkommen. Du hører på Horror Night på studentradioen i Trondheim.
Forhåpentligvis i hvert fall.
Radio Revolt.
Ja, vi satser på at det er Radio Revolt dette her.
Ja. Det hadde vært veldig gøy om teknikerne våre hadde klart å gjort det sånn at vi hadde tatt over for BBC, for eksempel.
Det hadde vært jævlig kult, men så er det et problem med sendere.
Ja, jeg tror ikke senderen er så sterk nok.
Nei, jeg tror ikke det. Og så tror jeg kanskje også det er noe med hvor mye teknikerne våre har lyst til å gjøre.
Ja,
for det må være ganske mye styr og kaper BBC, altså.
Ja, og så hva slags evner de har, ikke minst.
Ja, det er også sant.
Ikke det, jeg synes det er for så vidt godt gjort at de har klart å fått rigget opp her inne i biblioteket.
Det stemmer, det er bra det altså.
Masse kabler.
Det er jo stygt det, men gjemme det bak bøker så blir det bra, vet du.
Ja, men ikke midt på gulvet liksom, går ikke annet å dekke over kablene slik midt på gulvet.
Nei, de kablene, ja, nei, men det skal jo bygges inn i gulvet etter hvert.
Åja, skal det?
Ja.
Skeptisk.
Skeptisk til alt, du.
Ja, jeg er nok det. Hans,
yep.
Hva skal vi gjøre i dagens sending?
I dagens sending skal vi først kanskje si noe om Creative Commons lisens. Og så, når du har gjort det, så skal vi snakke litt mer om hva vi skal gjøre i den sendingen her.
Ja, nei, ja, det stemmer det. Takk for at du minner meg på det. Denne sendingen her er utgitt under Creative Commons lisens. Mer informasjon om det her kan du finne på internett, radiorevolt.no, og så sånn der sånn skråstrek, og så Horror Night i ett ord. Det er der teknikeren vår skriver på en lapp her, så det er vi.
Ja, det er det teknikeren vår påstår at funker. Vi har enda ikke testet ut denne mystiske, sære greien som er internett enda, men vi satser på at det funker.
Synes det virker overdrevet.
Ja.
Men dagens sending, tilbake til deg.
Ja, dagens sending. Vi skal snakke litt om en fyr som heter Stephen Crane. Hører litt på noe av det han har drevet med. A Goals Accountant. Mm. Så det er en interessant liten greie som vi skal spille for dere. Og skal vi snakke mer om I Nesbitt.
Ja, hun har vi jo hatt om flere ganger tidligere.
Det stemmer. Edith Nesbitt har vi hatt om før, men vi har fått ny informasjon.
Har vi sagt og uttalt oss om noe som var feil?
Ja. Vi er ikke ufeilbarlig, Trond.
Hadde min far vært i livet, så hadde han snudd seg i sin grav. Nei, du skjønner hva jeg mener.
Ja. Nei, vi har ikke gjort grunn nok research. I Nesbitt var nemlig kallenavnet hennes.
Ja.
Hun bare likte ikke å bli kalt Edith Nesbitt.
Så hennes venner kalte hun da for I Nesbitt. Ja. Sånn at hun var en av de da, ganske få av de kvinnelige horrorskribentene som da ikke brukte et pseudonym.
Nettopp.
Og vi har tydeligvis sagt tidligere at hun brukte pseudonym.
Ja, ryktene sier det. Jeg er enda ikke helt sikker på at hun faktisk har sagt det. Det er sikkert bare noe tull, noe sånn som har forkledd seg, som også har sagt noe sånt nå, men vel, vel, det er noe sånt.
Ja. Så vi skal gjennom litt av hvert da i løpet av sendingen. Og det her er ikke en temasending, det har vi hatt litt tidligere. Så det ønsker vi å få til mer av senere, mer temasendinger. Så hvis du har noen gode ideer på tema til en temasending, så kan du gjerne sende det inn til oss. Og da mener de at noe sånn her e-mail er greia.
Ja, e-mail greia. Horror night. Sånn krøllalfa ting av noe slag, radiorevolt.no.
Ja, men mens vi kan sjekke opp det til etterpå, her så kommer Triad med Arcadia. The weather beats down sometimes, so I go under that tree. For that sun that's due in life, 'cause I live for that dream. I
hair in trim. You see, it's non-alcoholic Charlie. It's made with pseudolanolin. You better get Wild Goose Cream Oil, Charlie. Start using it today. You'll find that you will have a tough time, Charlie. Keeping all those gals away, hiya, bully. Get a bottle right away. Your druggist has it. A little goes a long, long way. You hear it screaming. Keeps you looking neat all day.
Ja, der var vi tilbake igjen. Arcadia med Triad, hva du hørte da like noe nettopp da. Mm-hmm. Som sagt, har du tips til tema som vi kan ta for oss I et ut av de kommende Horror Night-programmene, så gjerne mail oss inn. Vi synes det skikkelig artig også å begrave oss I enkelttema, for at det finnes så mye ja, horror-relaterte tema der ute. Så det skikkelig stilig. Så, men hva slags stykker det vi skal høre I dag?
Det første A Ghoul's Accountant, som kommer tilbake til The Ebony Frame av E. Nesbitt etterpå.
Ja.
Stephen Crane, en merkelig skikke egentlig. Han ble bare 29 år gammel.
Ja, det jo litt typisk for gode skriventer da.
Det typisk for gode kunstnere generelt. De dør unge. Han ble født I 1871, sent på året, og døde midt I år 1900. Skrev en del forskjellige, altså romaner, kortfortellinger, poeter og så en del avisartikler. Mm. Journalist, hvor han ble med en gang ferdig med utdannelsen sin. Ja, amerikaner oppvokst her og der, og gått på skole, og så fant at det var ikke noe interessant å gjøre.
Det også veldig sånn typisk. De prøver seg gjerne på skolen, men det liksom ikke det deres kall
Nei. De trenger ikke skolegang for å bli flinke. Mm.
Det som litt stilig, jeg synes, med den sjangeren som vi jobber med, altså med horrorlitteratur, eller altså alle de forskjellige småsjangerene som går inn under det her, jeg synes det spennende for at man bruker en egen måte å legge frem en fortelling på. Altså den designet for å skal skremme deg på et eller annet vis, eller på et eller annet nivå.
Men altså, for eksempel Poe jo veldig kjent for å skrive god horror, men det ikke det at han skriver om fryktelige ting som gjør til en god horrorforfatter. Det jo det at han sannsynligvis god fullstand til å få en tur til butikken for å kjøpe en kartong mjølk til å bli noe virkelig fryktelig nydende.
Ja, mest sannsynligvis ikke noe problem. Ja,
her har vi jo The Ghoul's Accountant, som da litt samme greie, kan du si. Det en beskrivelse av noe. Det brukt horrorbeskrivelser på noe som ikke en horrorfortelling.
Nei, kanskje ikke. Vi må se litt på det, hva vi tenker på det når vi har hørt den. Den bare 6 minutter lang.
Yep.
Så den jo veldig grei å lytte gjennom. Også, det her så klart våre venner at LibriVox, som har fått spilt inn. Så anbefaler det. Så skal vi da høre A Ghoul's Accountant, og forfatteren av den var?
Stephen Crane.
A Ghoul's Accountant by Stephen Crane. In a wilderness, sunlight is noise. Darkness is a great, tremendous silence, accented by small and distant sounds. The music of the wind in the trees is songs of loneliness, hymns of abandonment, and lays of the absence of things congenial and alive. Once a campfire lay dying in a fit of temper. A few weak flames struggled cholerically among the burned-out logs. Beneath, a mass of angry, red coals glowered and hated the world. Some hemlocks sighed and sung, and a wind purred in the grass. The moon was looking through the locked branches at 4 imperturbable bundles of blankets which lay near the agonized campfire. The fire groaned in its last throes, but the bundles made no sign. Off in the gloomy unknown, a foot fell upon a twig. The laurel leaves shivered at the stealthy passing of danger. A moment later, a man crept into the spot of dim light. His skin was fiercely red and his whiskers infinitely black. He gazed at the four passive bundles and smiled a smile that curled his lips and showed yellow, disordered teeth. The campfire threw up two lurid arms and, quivering, expired. The voices of the trees grew hoarse and frightened. The bundles were stolid. The intruder stepped softly nearer and looked at the bundles. One was shorter than the others. He regarded it for some time motionless. The hemlocks quavered nervously and the grass shook. The intruder slid to the short bundle and touched it. Then he smiled. The bundle partially upreared itself, and the head of a little man appeared. "Lord," he said. He found himself looking at the grin of a ghoul condemned to torment. "Come," croaked the ghoul.
"What?"
said the little man. He began to feel his flesh slide to and fro on his bones as he looked into this smile. "Come," croaked the ghoul.
"What?"
the little man whimpered. He grew gray and could not move his legs. The ghoul lifted a three-pronged pickerel spear and flashed it near the little man's throat. He saw menace on its points. He struggled heavily to his feet. He cast his eyes upon the remaining mummy-like bundles, but the ghoul confronted his face with the spear.
"Where?"
shivered the little man. The ghoul turned and pointed into the darkness. His countenance shone with lurid light of triumph. "Go!" he croaked. The little man blindly staggered in the direction indicated. The three bundles by the fire were still immovable. He tried to pierce the cloth with a glance and opened his mouth to whoop, but the spear ever threatened his face. The bundles were left far in the rear, and the little man stumbled on alone with the ghoul. Tangled thickets tripped him, saplings buffeted him, and stones turned away from his feet. Blinded and badgered, he began to swear frenziedly. A foam drifted to his mouth, and his eyes glowed with a blue light. "Go on," thunderously croaked the ghoul. The little man's blood turned to salt. His eyes began to decay and refused to do their office. He fell from gloom to gloom. At last the house was before them. Through a yellow-papered window shone an uncertain light. The ghoul conducted his prisoner to the uneven threshold and kicked the decrepit door. It swung groaning back, and he dragged the little man into a room. A soiled oil lamp gave a feeble light that turned the pine-board walls and furniture a dull orange. Before a table sat a wild gray man. The ghoul threw his victim upon a chair and went and stood by the man. They regarded the little man with eyes that made wheels revolve in his soul. He cast a dazed glance about the room and saw vaguely that it was disheveled as from a terrific scuffle. Chairs lay shattered and dishes in the cupboard were ground to pieces. Destruction had been present. There were moments of silence. The ghoul and the wild gray man contemplated their victim. A throe of fear passed over him, and he sank limp in his chair. His eyes swept feverishly over the faces of his tormentors. At last the ghoul spoke. "Well," he said to the wild gray man. The other cleared his throat and stood up. "Stranger," he said suddenly, "how much is 33 bushels of potatoes at 64½ a bushel?" The ghoul leaned forward to catch the reply. The wild gray man straightened his figure and listened. A fierce light shone on their faces. Their breaths came swiftly. The little man wriggled his legs in agony. 21, no, 2, 6, quick, hissed the ghoul hoarsely.
$21.28½,
laboriously stuttered the little man. The ghoul gave a tremendous howl. "There, Tom Jones, dern ye," he yelled. "What did I tell yer? Hey, ain't I right? See? Didn't I tell yer that?" The wild gray man's body shook. He was delivered of a frightful roar. He sprang forward and kicked the little man out of the door.
Thank you.
Der hørte vi altså A Ghoul's Accountant. Og Hans, hva synes du om den her?
Altså, jeg må bare se om jeg har skjønt fortellingen riktig. Altså, det handler om en fyr som har blitt pirket på en ghoul, og så dratt inn i et rom hvor det sitter en annen fyr, som blir spurt om hvor mye er det der her. Og så sier han et eller annet tall, og så blir han sparket ut døra.
Ja. Så der summerte du sammen historien på 10 sekunder. 8-10 sekunder.
Såpass.
Ja, såpass. Det var bare så kult. Den var 6 minutter lang.
Ja.
6 minutter med forklaring for å på en måte med veldig sånn detaljert ordbruk, veldig detaljerte beskrivelser som skal, på en måte, som skal gi deg en følelse av frykt. Og så er handlingen så banal. Det liksom, ja.
Men det kan si at det er noe av det som gjør fortellingen så god som den er. Altså det er en, på den... Så når du hører den, så bare sitter du og lurer deg på hva Søren skal gjøre på sluttet av fortellingen. Mm. Og det synes jeg at den gjør den briljant, som en sånn humoristisk horror-greie, kan du si. Men den bygger opp forventninger om at nå skal det skje noe skikkelig jævlig nå, og så blir det sparket ut døra.
Ja, det er liksom ikke så ofte at stakkaren i en horrorfortelling faktisk bare kan gå ut av døra, bokstavlig talt.
Eller? Jeg blir sparket ut døra for Søren.
Ja, men liksom, det er veldig lite handling, og så er det så mye innpakning som gjør at det her faktisk er skikkelig effektivt.
Mm. Nei, så har en masse måten ting jeg har beskrevet på, er lignende litt på måten impresjonistene gjorde ting. Så du skal sammenligne med maling, eller malekunsten, som det heter. Mm. Så kan du... Si at det er klare farver, kan du si, som har brukt det. Altså det er klare trekk som er beskrevet. Det er ganske enkelt, sånn sett. Men det er et veldig stort inntrykk.
Mm.
Altså du får et veldig stort inntrykk av ganske enkle beskrivelser.
Ja.
Som da gjør at han, at herr Crane er blitt anerkjent som en modernistisk forfatter, kan, til dels hvertfall. Mm. Så det at han har klart å bruke et så enkelt språk, eller ikke enkelt språk, men så enkle litterære bilder til å beskrive store inntrykk som man får, og så har han disse fortellingene sine som egentlig ikke henger helt på grep.
Jeg synes det er jo veldig sånn spennende, men det er jo også i forhold til altså, folkefortellinger, historier, sånt, det håper jeg også at vi skal få fokusere litt på senere. Folkeeventyr og sånt.
Mm.
For der har du jo også det at har du en god forteller, så er det egentlig ikke nøye hva historien er for noe. Klart, har du ikke hørt den før? Vi har alle hørt veldig mye av det her norske folkefortellingen, så det er veldig artig å høre noe som man ikke har hørt. Men,
sant,
ja. Men fortellingskunsten er så viktig.
Mm, det er noe som er på vei ut også, kan man si, da, at det er den muntlige fortelletradisjonen er nå, vel ikke borte, men den blir mindre og mindre tilstedeværende, kan man si, da.
Og det kan man vel kanskje legge skylda på sånne moderne medier som svart-hvitt TV og AM og FM-radio.
Ja, egentlig. Nei, radioen vil jeg si er forsvarer for muntlig fortelling kunsten, til en viss del.
I hvert fall vi er det.
Vi gjør det, vi gjør det.
Vi nekter å gi oss på det.
Nettopp. Ja. Men det er svart-hvitt TV, altså. Uff,
ja, svart-hvitt TV. Jeg skjønner ikke hvorfor de orker å bruke tid på det helt tatt. Det er mye bedre å tenke seg frem til det her.
For det farger.
Det er jo derfor vi har de store hjernene som vi har. Det er jo for å kunne tenk og for å kunne se for oss det vi hører, og det er jo det som er det skikkelig bra med horrorlitteraturen, er jo det at du kan enkle tekster på papir og du kan skremme livskiten av deg selv med det.
Det stemmer. Hvorfor du har lyst til å skremme livskiten ut av oss selv er du ikke helt sikker på enda, men det finner vi ut etter hvert.
Det finner vi ut etter hvert. Kanskje vi må få en psykolog til å komme inn om.
Ja.
Jeg er litt engstelig for en sånn sjokkterapi, men...
Ja. Kanskje drømmetydningen til Freud er heller ikke helt... Nei.
Mm. Nei, vi må vurdere det sterkt.
Ja.
Men vi kan ta og gå videre. Vi skal høre Huxley Meets Soda og høre låta Special Feeling. We'll be right back. Da Huxley Meet Soda med låta Special Feeling.
Det var det nok helt sikkert. Teknikere var på så i hvert fall det, så
ja.
Det må det være sant.
Ja, du er fremdeles på Horror Night. Og nå skal vi over til en av
Nei, du hører på Teknovikingene.
Nei, Horror Night tror jeg. Jeg tror jeg ganske sikkert at det her er Horror Night.
Ja, jeg føler meg rimelig sikker på at det er Horror Night.
Jeg glober.
Blyforgiftning.
Andre programmer på Radio Revolt som anbefales å sjekke ut.
Nettopp.
I hvert fall de to siste. Den første kan man vel la være.
Ja, den første kan man la være med.
Ja. Vi skal over til en skribent som vi liker ganske godt. Hun er ikke helt der oppe med, sammen med Poe og Lovecraft, men hun har gjort et godt inntrykk på meg i hvert fall. Jeg vet ikke hvordan det er med deg, Hans.
Jo da, hun har gjort et godt inntrykk på meg også. Hun kan jo forstå sammenlignes litt med Mr. Crane. I det at de begge bruker beskrivelser veldig aktivt i fortellingen sin. Altså, Nesbitt gjør ganske mye rart med rart. Hun er veldig flink til å mane frem litterære, altså bilder i hodene våre, yeah. Via hjelp av bruk av ganske store og kompliserte litterære bilder. Så hvis dere kan finne sitat her nå. She has an economy of phrase and an unparalleled talent for evoking hot summer days in the English countryside. Yeah. Altså noe helt vanvittig britisk.
Ja, det kan vi jo si om hun. Altså, hun skrev jo masse barnebøker.
40 eller noe, tror jeg.
40 eller noe sånt, barnebøker. Og da er det jo på en måte ikke unaturlig at hun faktisk har en god evne til å lage bilder med ord. For at det er jo det som lager en god fortelling for unger. Sånn at det er ikke så ulikt på mange måter.
Nei, altså sånn at du kan sammenligne horror-litteratur med barnebøker. Fortelling spiller ikke så jævlig stor rolle. Det er bildene som vi får i hodene av dem som er det faktisk viktige her.
Derfor så bør du fortelle horrorfortellinger til dine små barn.
Det er den logiske følgende dette her. Nå har jeg ikke unger, så jeg kan ikke teste det enda.
Ikke heller.
Nei, men det kommer nok en dag, så vi får teste teorien og se hvor sinnssyke de blir.
Ja, nei, vi tar ikke ansvar for eventuell horrorlitteratur dere leser til dere små barn.
Vi tar ikke ansvar for hva som skjer med dere hvis dere hører på programmet vårt, heller.
Nei, vi tar ikke ansvar i det hele tatt, faktisk.
Vi skal ha ansvar for at dere skal ha noe å høre på, da.
Ja, det skal vi gjøre. Vi skal høre The Ebony Frame. Og den her, det er faktisk på 31 minutter. Det er igjen Libervox som står bak. Og ja, så snakkes vi neste veka.
Ny god sending. Kveld, folkens.
God kveld, folkens. Så kommer E. Nesbitt med The Ebony Frame.
The Ebony Frame by E. Nesbitt. To be rich is a luxurious sensation, the more so when you have plumbed the depths of hard-upness as a Fleet Street hack, a picker-up of unconsidered pars, a reporter, an unappreciated journalist, all callings utterly inconsistent with one's family feeling and one's direct descent from the Dukes of Picardy. When my Aunt Dorcas died and left me 700 a year and a furnished house in Chelsea, I felt that life had nothing left to offer except immediate possession of the legacy. Even Mildred Mayhew, whom I had hitherto regarded as my life's light, became less luminous. I was not engaged to Mildred, but I lodged with her mother, and I sang duets with Mildred, and gave her gloves when it would run to it, which was seldom. She was a dear, good girl, and I meant to marry her some day. It is very nice to feel that a good little woman is thinking of you. It helps you in your work, and it is pleasant to know she will say yes when you say, will you? But my legacy almost put Mildred out of my head, especially as she was staying with friends in the country. Before the gloss was off my new mourning, I was seated in my aunt's armchair, in front of the fire, in the drawing-room of my own house. My own house. It was grand, but rather lonely. I did think of Mildred just then. The room was comfortably furnished with rosewood and damask. On the walls hung a few fairly good oil paintings, but the space above the mantelpiece was disfigured by an exceedingly bad print, The Trial of Lord William Russell, framed in a dark frame. I got up to look at it. I had visited my aunt with dutiful regularity, but I never remembered seeing this frame before. It was not intended for a print, but for an oil painting. It was of fine ebony, beautifully and curiously carved. I looked at it with growing interest, and when my aunt's housemaid, I had retained her modest staff of servants, came in with the lamp, I asked her how long the print had been there. "Mistress only bought it 2 days before she was took ill," she said. "But the frame, she didn't want to buy a new one, so she got this out of the attic. There's lots of curious old things there, sir." "Had my aunt had this frame long?" "Oh, yes, sir. It must have come long before I did, and I've been here 7 years come Christmas. There was a picture in it. That's upstairs, too, but it's that black and ugly it might as well be a chimney back." I felt a desire to see this picture. What if it was some priceless old master, in which my aunt's eyes had only seen rubbish? Directly after breakfast next morning, I paid a visit to the attic. It was crammed with old furniture enough to stock a curiosity shop. All the house was furnished solidly in the mid-Victorian style, and in this room, everything not in keeping with the drawing-room suite ideal was stowed away. Tables of papier-mâché, and mother-of-pearl, straight-backed chairs with twisted feet and faded needlework cushions, fire-screens of gilded carving and beaded banners, oak bureau with brass handles, a little work-table with its faded, moth-eaten silk flutings hanging in disconsolate shreds. On these, and the dust that covered them, blazed the full sunlight as I pulled up the blinds. I promised myself a good time in re-enshrining these household gods in my parlour and promoting the Victorian suite to the attic. But at present my business was to find the picture as black as the chimney back, and presently, behind a heap of fenders and boxes, I found it. Jane, the housemaid, identified it at once. I took it downstairs carefully and examined it. Neither subject nor colour was distinguishable. There was a splodge of a darker tint in the middle, but whether it was figure or tree or house, no man could have told. It seemed to be painted on a very thick panel bound with leather. I decided to send it to one of those persons who pour on rotting family portraits the water of eternal youth. But even as I did so, I thought, why not try my own restorative hand at a corner of it? My bath sponge, soap, and nail brush, vigorously applied for a few seconds, showed me that there was no picture to clean. Bare oak presented itself to my persevering brush. I tried the other side, Jane watching me with indulgent interest. The same result. Then the truth dawned on me. Why was the panel so thick? I tore off the leather binding, and the panel divided and fell to the ground in a cloud of dust. There were two pictures. They had been nailed face to face. I leaned them against the wall, and the next moment I was leaning against it myself. For one of the pictures was myself, a perfect portrait. No shade of expression or turn of feature wanting. Myself, in the dress men wore when James I was king. When had this been done? And how, without my knowledge? Was this some whim of my aunt's? "Laura, sir!" the shrill surprise of Jane at my elbow. "What a lovely photo it is! Was it a fancy ball, sir?" "Yes," I stammered. I don't think I want anything more now. You can go." She went, and I turned, still with my heart beating violently, to the other picture. This was a beautiful woman's picture. Very beautiful she was. I noted all her beauties: straight nose, low brows, full lips, thin hands, large, deep, luminous eyes. She wore a black velvet gown. It was a three-quarter-length portrait. Her arms rested on a table beside her, and her head on her hands, but her face was turned full forward, and her eyes met those of the spectator bewilderingly. On the table by her were compasses, and shining instruments whose uses I did not know, books, a goblet, and a heap of papers and pens. I saw all this afterwards. I believe it was a quarter of an hour before I could turn my eyes from her. I have never seen any other eyes like hers. They appealed, as a child's or a dog's do. They commanded, as might those of an empress. "Shall I sweep up the dust, sir?" Curiosity had brought Jane back. I acceded. I turned from her my portrait. I kept between her and the woman in the black velvet. When I was alone again, I tore down the trial of Lord William Russell, and I put the picture of the woman in its strong ebony frame. Then I wrote to a frame-maker for a frame for my portrait. It had so long lived face to face with this beautiful witch that I had not the heart to banish it from her presence. I suppose I am sentimental, if it be sentimental to think such things as that. The new frame came home, and I hung it opposite the fireplace. An exhaustive search among my aunt's papers showed no explanation of the portrait of myself, no history of the portrait of the woman with the wonderful eyes. I only learned that all the old furniture together had come to my aunt at the death of my great-uncle, the head of the family, and I should have concluded that the resemblance was only a family one, if everyone who came in had not exclaimed at the speaking likeness. I adopted Jane's fancy ball explanation. And there, one might suppose, the matter of the portraits ended. One might suppose it, that is, if there were not evidently a good deal more written here about it. However, to me, then, the matter seemed ended. I went to see Mildred. I invited her and her mother to come and stay with me. I rather avoided glancing at the picture in ebony frame. I could not forget, nor remember without singular emotion, the look in the eyes of that woman when mine first met them. I shrank from meeting that look again. I reorganized the house somewhat, preparing for Mildred's visit. I brought down much of the old-fashioned furniture, and after a long day of arranging and rearranging, I sat down before the fire, and lying back in a pleasant languor, I idly raised my eyes to the picture of the woman. I met her dark, deep, hazel eyes, and once more my gaze was held fixed as by strong magic, the kind of fascination that keeps one sometimes staring for whole minutes into one's own eyes in the glass. I gazed into her eyes and felt my own dilate, pricked with a smart like the smart of tears. "I wish," I said, "oh, how I wish you were a woman and not a picture. Come down. Ah, come down." I laughed at myself as I spoke, but even as I laughed, I held out my arms. I was not sleepy. I was not drunk. I was as wide awake and as sober as ever was a man in the world. And yet, as I held out my arms, I saw the eyes of the picture dilate, her lips tremble. If I were to be hanged for saying it, it is true. Her hands moved slightly, and a sort of flicker of a smile passed over her face. I sprang to my feet. "This won't do," I said aloud. "Firelight does play strange tricks. I'll have the lamp." I made for the bell. My hand was on it when I heard a sound behind me and turned, the bell still unrung. The fire had burned low, and the corners of the room were deeply shadowed. But surely, there, behind the tall worked chair, was something darker than a shadow. "I must face this out," I said, "or I shall never be able to face myself again." I left the bell, I seized the poker, and battered the dull coals to a blaze. Then I stepped back resolutely and looked at the picture. The ebony frame was empty. From the shadow of the worked chair came a soft rustle, and out of the shadow the woman of the picture was coming towards me. I hope I shall never again know a moment of terror as blank and absolute. I could not have moved or spoken to save my life. Either all the known laws of nature were nothing, or I was mad. I stood trembling, but, I am thankful to remember, I stood still, while a black velvet gown swept across the hearthrug towards me. Next moment a hand touched me. A hand, soft, warm, and human, and a low voice said, "You called me. I am here." At that touch, and that voice, the world seemed to give a sort of bewildering half-turn. I hardly know how to express it, but at once it seemed not awful, not even unusual, for portraits to become flesh, only most natural, most right, most unspeakably fortunate. I laid my hand on hers. I looked from her to my portrait. I could not see it in the firelight. "We are not strangers," I said. "Oh, no, not strangers." Those luminous eyes were looking up into mine. Those red lips were near me. With a passionate cry, a sense of having recovered life's one great good that had seemed wholly lost, I clasped her in my arms. She was no ghost. She was a woman, the only woman in the world. "How long," I said, "how long is it since I lost you?" She leaned back, hanging her full weight on the hands that were clasped behind my head. "How can I tell how long? There is no time in hell," she answered. It was not a dream. Ah, no, there are no such dreams. I wish to God there could be. When in dreams do I see her eyes, hear her voice, feel her lips against my cheek, hold her hands to my lips, as I did that night, the supreme night of my life. At first we hardly spoke. It seemed enough, after long grief and pain, to feel the arms of my true love round me once again. It is very difficult to tell my story. There are no words to express the sense of glad reunion, the complete realization of every hope and dream of a life that came upon me as I sat with my hand in hers and looked into her eyes. How could it have been a dream, when I left her sitting in the straight-backed chair and went down to the kitchen to tell the maids I should want nothing more, that I was busy and did not wish to be disturbed, when I fetched wood for the fire with my own hands, and, bringing it in, found her still sitting there, saw the little brown head turn as I entered, saw the love in her dear eyes, when I threw myself at her feet and blessed the day I was born, since life had given me this. Not a thought of Mildred. All other things in my life were a dream. This, its one splendid reality. "I'm wondering," she said after a while, when we had made such cheer, each of the other, as true lovers may, after long parting. "I'm wondering how much you remember of our past." "I remember nothing but that I love you, that I have loved you all my life." "You remember nothing? Really nothing?" "Only that I am truly yours, that we have both suffered, that—" "Tell me, my mistress dear, all that you remember. Explain it all to me. Make me understand. And yet, no, I don't want to understand. It is enough that we are together." "If it was a dream, why have I never dreamed it again?" She leaned down towards me. Her arm lay on my neck, and drew my head till it rested on her shoulder. "I am a ghost, I suppose," she said, laughing softly, and her laughter stirred memories which I just grasped at and just missed. "But you and I know better, don't we? I will tell you everything you have forgotten. We loved each other. Ah, no, you have not forgotten that. And when you came back from the wars, we were to be married. Our pictures were painted before you went away. You know I was more learned than women of that day. Dear one, when you were gone, they said I was a witch. They tried me. They said I should be burned. Just because I had looked at the stars and gained more knowledge than other women, they must needs bind me to a stake and let me be eaten by the fire. And you, far away." Her whole body trembled and shrank. "Oh, love, what dream would have told me that my kisses would soothe even that memory? The night before," she went on, "the devil did come to me. I was innocent before. You know it, don't you? And even then my sin was for you. For you, because of the exceeding love I bore you. The devil came, and I sold my soul to eternal flame. But I got a good price. I got the right to come back through my picture, if anyone, looking at it, wished for me, as long as my picture stayed in its ebony frame. That frame was not carved by man's hand. I got the right to come back to you, oh, my heart's heart. And another thing I won, which you shall hear anon. They burned me for a witch. They made me suffer hell on earth. Those faces, all crowding round, the crackling wood and the choking smell of the smoke. Oh, love, no more, no more! When my mother sat that night before my picture, she wept and cried, 'Come back, my poor lost child.' And I went to her with glad leaps of heart. Dear, she shrank from me. She fled. She shrieked and moaned of ghosts. She had our pictures covered from sight and put again in the ebony frame. She had promised me my picture should stay always there. Ah, through all these years, your face was against mine. she paused. But the man you loved? You came home. My picture was gone. They lied to you, and you married another woman. But someday, I knew you would walk the world again, and that I should find you. The other gain? I asked. The other gain, she said slowly, I gave my soul for. It is this. If you also will give up your hopes of heaven, I can remain a woman. I can remain in your world. I can be your wife. Oh, my dear, after all these years, at last... If I sacrifice my soul, I said slowly, and the words did not seem an imbecility. If I sacrifice my soul, I win you. Why, love, it's a contradiction in terms. You are my soul. Her eyes looked straight into mine. Whatever might happen, whatever did happen, whatever may happen, our two souls in that moment met and became one. Then you choose. You deliberately choose to give up your hopes of heaven for me, as I gave up mine for you? I will not, I said, give up my hope of heaven on any terms. Tell me what I must do, that you and I may make our heaven here, as now. I will tell you tomorrow, she said. Be alone here tomorrow night. 12 is ghost's time, isn't it? And then I will come out of the picture and never go back to it. I shall live with you and die and be buried, and there will be an end of me. But we shall live first, my heart's heart. I laid my head on her knee. A strange drowsiness overcame me. Holding her hand against my cheek, I lost consciousness. When I awoke, the grey November dawn was glimmering, ghost-like, through the uncurtained window. My head was pillowed on my arm and rested. I raised my head quickly. Ah, not on my lady's knee, but on the needle-worked cushion of the straight-backed chair. I sprang to my feet. I was stiff with cold and dazed with dreams, but I turned my eyes on the picture. There she sat, my lady, my dear love. I held out my arms, but the passionate cry I would have uttered died on my lips. She had said 12 o'clock. Her lightest word was my law. So I only stood in front of the picture and gazed into those grey-green eyes till tears of passionate happiness filled my own. Oh, my dear, how shall I pass the hours till I hold you again? No thought, then, of my whole life's completion and consummation being a dream. I staggered up to my room, fell across my bed, and slept heavily and dreamlessly. When I awoke, it was high noon. Mildred and her mother were coming to lunch. I remembered, at 1 o'clock, Mildred coming, and her existence. Now indeed the dream began. With a penetrating sense of the futility of any action apart from her, I gave the necessary orders for the reception of my guests. When Mildred and her mother came, I received them with cordiality, but my genial phrases all seemed to be someone else's. My voice sounded like an echo. My heart was not there. Still, the situation was not intolerable until the hour when afternoon tea was served in the drawing-room. Mildred and mother kept the conversational pot boiling with a profusion of genteel commonplaces, and I bore it, as one inside of heaven can bear mild purgatory. I looked up at my sweetheart in the ebony frame, and I felt that anything which might happen, any irresponsible imbecility, any bathos of boredom, was nothing if, after all, she came to me again. And yet, when Mildred, too, looked at the portrait and said, "Doesn't she think a lot of herself?
theatrical character, I suppose. One of your flames, Mr. Devine. I had a sickening sense of impotent irritation, which became absolute torture when Mildred... How could I ever have admired that chocolate-box barmaid style of prettiness? Threw herself into the high-backed chair, covering the needlework with ridiculous flounces, and added, "Silence gives consent. Who is it, Mr. Devine? Tell us all about her. I'm sure she has a story." Poor little Mildred, sitting there smiling, serene in her confidence that her every word charmed me, sitting there with her rather pinched waist, her rather tight boots, her rather vulgar voice, sitting in the chair where my dear lady had sat when she told me her story. I could not bear it. "Don't sit there," I said. "It's not comfortable." But the girl would not be warned. With a laugh that set every nerve in my body vibrating with annoyance, she said, "Oh, dear! Mustn't I even sit in the same chair as your black velvet woman?" I looked at the chair in the picture. It was the same, and in her chair Mildred was sitting. Then a horrible sense of the reality of Mildred came upon me. Was all this a reality, after all? But for fortunate chance, might Mildred have occupied not only her chair, but her place in my life? I rose. "I hope you won't think me very rude," I said, "but I'm obliged to go out." I forget what appointment I alleged. The lie came readily enough. I faced Mildred's pouts with the hope that she and her mother would not wait dinner for me. I fled. In another minute I was safe, alone, under the chill, cloudy autumn sky, free to think of my dear lady. I walked for hours along streets and squares. I lived over and over again every look, word, and hand touch, every kiss. I was completely, unspeakably happy. Mildred was utterly forgotten. My lady of the ebony frame filled my heart and soul and spirit. As I heard 11 boom through the fog, I turned and went home. When I got to my street, I found a crowd surging through it, a strong red light filling the air. A house was on fire. "Mine!" I elbowed my way through the crowd. The picture of my lady, that at least I could save. As I sprang up the steps, I saw, as in a dream, yes, all this was really dreamlike, I saw Mildred leaning out of the first floor window, wringing her hands. "Come back, sir," cried a fireman. "We'll get the young lady out right enough." "But my lady..." The stairs were crackling, smoking, and as hot as hell. I went up to the room where her picture was. Strange to say, I only felt that the picture was a thing we should like to look on through the long, glad, wedded life that was to be ours. I never thought of it as being one with her. As I reached the first floor, I felt arms about my neck. The smoke was too thick for me to distinguish features. "Save me," a voice whispered. I clasped a figure in my arms and bore it with a strange dis-ease down the shaking stairs and out into safety. It was Mildred. I knew that directly I clasped her. "Stand back," cried the crowd. "Everyone safe," cried a fireman. The flames leaped from every window. The sky grew redder and redder. I sprang from the hands that would have held me. I leaped up the steps. I crawled up the stairs. Suddenly, the whole horror came to me. As long as my picture remains in the ebony frame, what if picture and frame perished together? I fought with the fire, and with my own choking inability to fight with it, I pushed on. I must save my picture. I reached the drawing room. As I sprang in, I saw my lady, I swear it, through the smoke and the flames, hold out her arms to me, who came too late to save her, and to save my own life's joy. I never saw her again. Before I could reach her, or cry out to her, I felt the floor yield beneath my feet, and I fell into the flames below. How did they save me? What does that matter? They saved me somehow, curse them. Every stick of my aunt's furniture was destroyed. My friends pointed out that, as the furniture was heavily insured, the carelessness of a nightly studious housemaid had done me no harm. No harm. That was how I won and lost my only love. I deny, with all my soul in the denial, that it was a dream. There are no such dreams. Dreams of longing and pain there are in plenty, but dreams of complete, of unspeakable happiness. Ah, no, it is the rest of life that is the dream. But if I think that, why have I married Mildred and grown stout and dull and prosperous? I tell you, it is all this that is the dream. My dear lady only is the reality. And what does it matter what one does in a dream?
Thank you.